Good morning. It is Thursday, the 8th of July. Welcome to the Roundtable. I am Joe Donahue. It is very nice to have you here on our panel program, and we really enjoy having you here. Panel at WAMC.org. And if you would like to write to us on any of the subjects that we talk about today, panel at WAMC.org is the way to do it. Let me introduce our group to you this morning, and then we will get started. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, fresh from a taping of the Media Project. Good morning, sir. How did that go?
It was fresh.
All is good?
Yes.
Excellent. All right.
It was excellent. And, you know, a very important panelist has just shown up.
Yes, we are. We have a full group now. That's good. By the way, just a reminder, Alan and I would like to remind you that tomorrow we are broadcasting live from Tanglewood. We will be doing a special broadcast from 9 to noon from the Tanglewood Press Porch. We used to do these every single solitary year until last year when the world stopped.
Yep.
And so we didn't do it last year. We will get back to it tomorrow. We're very excited. And you always liken it to
camp.
Summer camp. Yes.
If you've ever been at the Tanglewood Press porch, you know what I mean. It's really quite woody, quite great. You know, it has that the right smell to it. And that's why we...
What we were talking about earlier.
And we will meet, by the way, we will meet the new executive director of Tanglewood.
The new CEO, Gail Samuel, will be with us.
Replacing the incredible Mark Volpe, who we just loved.
You just talked to on your program, I think, last week.
Yeah,
last
Thursday.
So that'll be a lot of fun. So we look forward to that, and we welcome you to join us tomorrow morning, 9 to noon at Tanglewood. Not join us, join us on the radio. You can't come to Tanglewood and join
us.
No,
you can't.
No.
Don't do that.
We just don't have room for you. We call it the press porch, but it's a small area.
It
is basically the size of a porch, so you get the idea. And there's a big Steinway in the middle of it, so that's an issue, too. Let me introduce the panel to you. Of course, Alan is here, and who I guess I started introducing. Heather Bruschetti just joined us. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thanks.
President and CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Great to have you here. Thank you.
Great to be here.
We also welcome Sienna Freeman Tolbert, immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Good morning, Sienna.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. And Siena College professor of comparative politics, Vera Acarius Kelly. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning, everyone.
Nice to have you all here. All right, let's go to what is happening in the news. A lot happening, and we'll get to it. A reminder, you can join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you on any of these issues. Well, I think this one, sadly and tragically, we knew was coming, but it is still nonetheless very sad. But the condo collapse response, this is in Surfside, Florida, that the response has now shifted from rescue to recovery. Officials say there is virtually no chance of additional survivors. That massive search effort ended its second week in shifting to a recovery mode. Crews that once hoped to rescue someone from pockets in the ruins of the towers have discovered only bodies in the aftermath of a catastrophe that officials are still trying to explain. With 86 people still unaccounted for, authorities say that they found 18 additional victims, with the highest number recorded in a day yesterday. That pushed the known death toll to 54 as a prosecutor enlisted a grand jury to examine the disaster, and in court, a judge began to tackle the impossible task of compensating people for their losses. Alan.
You know, this is going to set off a self-examination on the part of everybody who ever built a building, manages a building, every co-op, every condo. The lawyers, like Sienna and so many others, are just beginning to understand what a windfall this is. This is going to be, because everybody's going to want a lawyer to do this. And can you imagine one day you're sitting there, you're pretty pumped up about being the chair of a condo board, or and then all of a sudden prosecutors are impaneling grand juries. You know, you can go from 100 to zero really fast.
Well, and that idea of compensation, Sienna, seems almost, I mean, how do you compensate for the loss of a wife, or the loss of a child, you know?
Exactly. And that's the hard part in this situation is I was, you know, looking at this case and trying to figure out who do you sue? Where do you start? You know, it's the obvious, you go to the building, but then they mentioned the insurers, people that are supposed to come in and inspect, people that should have been looking at all of these various like points before we got to the point where the foundation was crushing. And the government. Is the government involved? Does the government have a piece of that liability as well? So, I mean, I think it's very, very vast. And I think there are attorneys. I hear that there are attorneys volunteering their services right now to help those individuals who need compensation during this time, in addition to homes to live in and figuring out what to do for the loss of their loved ones. So, yeah, it's a big deal right now.
And not to mention that, but you have this catastrophe. And then the concern of what else, other issues there are, structural damage throughout that region, the people who were responsible for this building, responsible for other buildings, ...
Exactly. And I was just thinking about what Alan said with HOA boards. And I mean, you volunteer for these boards, you sit on these boards. Do you become named in the lawsuit because you didn't choose to, you know, push forward a measure to look at this? Or I think the implications are widespread. It's just widespread. And I just, you know, I feel for the individuals that were who lost their life, for the, you know, family members. But I also know it's going to be very complex. And I know that there's a lot of attorneys down there right now trying to figure it all out.
We're just not used to buildings just falling down. I mean, without explosives or, you know, done on purpose. This is just, it fell. And so a lot of this is uncharted territory.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, it is.
But it will be chartered really quickly now, in that what never would have been procedure is going to turn into procedure for watching what's happening to your building in your condo. Don't you think?
Exactly. I mean, and you know, high rises. They were saying this is a phenomenon in Florida, but think about, we're thinking about New York.
Sure.
We have some, you know, Albany, we have a couple of high rises. I mean, you just, it's going to, and we have high rises with individuals living in it. Like here in Albany, I was just driving past one other day and I thought about it. I was like,
right.
I wonder how that building is, you know, and I'm sure that everyone's looking into that.
Absolutely.
I think in particular in combination with salt water, that's the issue. You know, they're going to look at rebar and the kind of, you know, what they found already was that the rebar was not sufficient. It was not constructed the way the plan said or that was promised. And also salt water deteriorates rebar. And that's why you have to drill in and check. And they didn't do that.
And could you remind us all, especially me, what rebar is?
So it's the it's the steel enforcement.
Where you go back for another drink.
Yeah, this is where the political science scientists should not explain anything on architectural construction or any on a building construction, but it's sort
it's
of the
a, it's
steel
a reinforcement
the
bar.
The steel reinforcement that you have in all buildings, but particularly tall buildings.
Almost the skeleton, the steel skeleton of the building.
And I was just saying, and just based on that, just think about how deep that's going to go in liability, right? Who knew about that the structure wasn't stable? Who knew? And it's going to be a ripple effect.
Well, I mean, the other thing is there's going to be a whole lot of new looking at what kind of expertise do we need to have to be on these condo boards when they call in an expert to look at the structure.
Sure.
You know, what are their qualifications? Because this place had been looked at. Some people had actually pointed out deficiencies in the structure, and really nothing was done about it. You know, there's a whole bunch of buildings that were built around the same time, I think by the same company.
Yes.
In the area, and I for one wouldn't want to be one of the people living in there. I think the worst part is this is going to be a slow motion tragedy. I mean, every day we're going to have dribs and drabs of more people found and, you know, have stories about their lives. And it's just, it's going to be excruciating for a period of time.
Well, right. And we haven't even started the process of burial and still recovering the bodies. And it's, and we know that there are children there, and it's horrifying. The other thing too, to what you were saying, as far as, you know, other buildings and what you think of, and Vera touched on this as well, but you know, any building really on the East Coast of, mm-hmm. of a high rise will be questionable.
Right.
And in the West Coast, too, obviously. But what is also fascinating, I mean, it's fascinating in the sense that you wonder what will happen. But we're just the beginning of this. It was the building. Like, the building collapsed, and now we're finding out all this information of, oh, well, there was this report in 2018, and then we knew this, and then they were told that. And and you look at that report that came in 2018 that they sent the residents of the condo. I know you're a lawyer, Sienna, but good luck for any mm-hmm. normal mortal yeah. person learning, and knowing what that said.
Exactly.
Good luck. I mean, there were like words like concerning and unstable, but for the most part, I wouldn't have known that the severity in reading that report, which apparently was quite serious.
And as someone that's lived with an HOA, I can just say that when they present these reports to you, even as an attorney, I look at them, I go to the bottom line, I say, how much is it going to cost me in HOA mm-hmm. fees? What do you want us to do? How much of an increase, or, you know, what have you? What are you asking us to do? And a lot of people don't even show up to those HOA board meetings.
No.
Like, they just don't show up. They don't participate. They
and you remind everybody what the words HOA mean.
Homeowner Association. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to also point out that owners in that particular Surfside building paid in the last couple of years $60,000 to $100,000 in fees just to maintain the basics. And then the additional costs were incredibly high. I think they mentioned multiple $1 million. And so it became prohibitively expensive, actually, for somebody to own an apartment in this particular building. And also in neighboring buildings, several have been identified and now also evacuated. So this is this has a ripple effect already, and
nationwide.
Nationwide, I think we'll see it on the East Coast in the coming weeks, likely once they begin seriously inspecting. But Florida, in particular, does not have a strong code enforcement issue. You know, they have had issues with that, where the government has yeah. not really insisted on code enforcement. So this will be an added layer, I think, in the larger conversation of how much you pay for these condos and what your assessed fees are. And do you buy into those condos and you have no idea what the fees are down the road?
Well,
I mean,
you
imagine you buy a $60,000 apartment or $100,000 apartment and your assessment for repairs is another $100,000.
Sure. Well, we're glad that we have Heather with us today, because she's got all of these businesses that she's responsible for. And, you know, middle of the night paranoia should not be limited just to what's going on in Florida, because these are all what-if situations. What if somebody has once reminded or said something to me that now we ignored then, but we now think, you know, maybe we should have paid a little bit more attention to.
Yeah, I mean, you always have the challenge between when we're talking about construction and builders, you know, generally speaking, builders will build to code. They'll build to what the codes are. If the codes aren't sufficient, you know, then what? I mean, if this is a situation where every you know, I was dotted, every T was, and I'm not saying it is. I don't know the answer to that. But let's assume they were in full compliance. Then what's the solution? There ought to be some liability. And I suppose there's always a desire to find someone with a deep pocket to blame. The insurance is not going to be sufficient on this building. Mm-hmm. The homeowner's insurance on the individual units is not going to be sufficient. It is a tragedy all the way around. And you know, I think that if I was in the building business, I would build to code plus some to try and make sure that I'm not risking any liability mm-hmm. 40 years after I build a building.
Sure. I mean, you said drips and drabs earlier, and you were talking about the tragedy of the story, but
right.
we're also going to get the drips and drabs as to what the how it affects the future for
right.
code, for state response, for board response,
For building inspectors, can you imagine what's going through their mind at 1 o'clock in the morning?
And town board, village boards, town boards, city boards.
And I think a lot of times folks volunteer to be on these things, like homeowners associations, which, by the way, in my experience, the fighting is usually, if it's not about fees, it's about what color somebody's door is or, you know, is
a lot about pets.
Is the addition to their garage too big compared to the rest of the garages in the community? I mean,
pets and trees.
It's a lot of people who feel empowered over relatively minor, I'm not going to say, sometimes petty things, not about the structural integrity of the building. I mean, and that is their responsibility, but I don't think that that's something that is clear to people when they decide to participate in these things.
Also, I only take issue with you on one thing. I don't think anyone decides to participate. I think they are forced into it.
I don't know. I will say
they love it. They love it.
All right.
I will say there are people who are in their glory in these.
All right,
Heather, you are so right.
I know. Maybe my personal experience is we would all gladly it over to somebody else. But finding other people who want to do that is very difficult for obvious reasons, for all the reasons that we mentioned.
So maybe in the future we should have engineers and architects on some of those.
Or at least
I guarantee
some...
you there are.
Yeah.
Lawyers, lawyers, architects, engineers, those are all good people to have on your accountants.
Yeah, but there needs to be someone who is ultimately responsible for validating the integrity of the building, right? And who is that person? Because that's the kind of thing when you see, you know, for example, when you see audits by accounting firms, they say, well, we're vouching for this to the extent that the information that was provided to us is correct. Somebody's got to be the ultimate holder of responsibility.
Well, right. And that's, I mean, we're already seeing this in the stories that are coming out of this situation where there are, and you hear of these stories often where, when you talk about code, the condo board, they're going to their bylaws. This is what goes by our bylaws. But the county or the town or whatever the governing forces may have a different set of rules, and it then becomes very murky as to what you're following and what is right and what is wrong.
Yeah.
Because they can overrule you, obviously.
Right. So imagine you're the person constructing the building.
Right.
I mean, what do you have? You have the code. You have to follow the code.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine if you're any of them?
Yeah.
Anything to do with this, you're not sleeping at night.
No, and of course, the victims and the people, families who have lost people in there and still don't know where they are.
And I'm sure everyone who's on that association knows someone.
We have to take a break. We'll be right back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Heather Bruschetti, and Vera Acarius-Kelly with us this morning. We do have letters on the subject we've been talking about, which is the ongoing crisis and tragedy in Surfside, Florida. So Bob writes, any prospective purchaser of a condo whose attorney doesn't read a year or two worth of board of directors minutes to find out the condition of the building's physical plant and finances should get a better lawyer. Dire conditions rarely arise overnight and are percolating for years before a crisis arrives. Well, I'm not, you know, hindsight is 20/20, of course, but it's really hard when there are so many differing reports and things. There seems to be a lot of different information, but of course we'll know more as the investigation goes on. Julius writes, concrete is porous. A proper drainage isn't provided in the design and construction. Embedded unprotected reinforcing steel will corrode. Proper grade reinforcing steel is coated to provide corrosion protection and improved concrete adhesion. So the question I have on that letter is, okay, so where is that happening elsewhere?
Well, that's exactly what they're going to check now in other buildings because you have to drill in and do some testing.
And Julius knows all about, I know this guy, and he knows all about roads, you know, and what goes on with roads and what kind of reinforcement. So I have a feeling.
So the infrastructure guy.
Yes.
All right. Robert writes, you mentioned governmental responsibility for this disaster. How does Governor DeSantis figure into responsibility? Anyone
I'm sure in his mind, not at all, but I mean, he's not going to say this was our fault. He's not going to say this was a failure to you know, properly inspect businesses or buildings. I mean, I think, I don't see him taking responsibility, but he might, you know, lead the charge on some new enforcement or something.
This is mean, and I may get letters, but I will say that his reaction so far to the tragedy of this has been the first time that I have seen signs of him being a human.
Well, yeah. Not only that, you got a president of the United States who is basically saying nice things about the guy who probably, if Trump isn't, will be the opponent in the next presidential election.
Kathleen writes, I was on my co-op board for a number of years, and I saw two very clear problems. When we received engineers' reports, we needed help prioritizing improvements and repairs, and the engineers were often reluctant to do that. Management companies across the board in New York City seemed to be very incompetent. One of our management agents was borderline illiterate. We had to fire several over the years.
Yeah, I think what this reference is, I know a little bit about this, is that the co-op board, not wanting to take the responsibility or the kind of board, they hire a management company that will do that. And so instead of hearing from the co-op board, you're going to hear from the management company on many different occasions. But now they're going to duke that out between the board and the management company.
But I I've looked at some of the engineering reports, and I must say they're incredibly difficult to understand if that's not your field or your expertise. So I can understand that when you just simply get an assessment of the building, it's incredibly hard. When the writer said it was difficult to prioritize, right?
Yes.
So the language might be somewhat unclear. There are issues, but one does not know unless you have expertise in the field what issues are really serious and need to be addressed immediately. And that is also one of those fundamental questions about who has the expertise to explain to owners what needs to be done ASAP and what can be postponed by a decade.
Well, you know, there is something called the CYA rule.
I'm sorry, for those of us who don't know, what is CYA?
Cover your behind.
Yeah. Mine starts with a B. Yeah. I'm sorry, what?
All right.
Yeah. So, you know, you better believe that a lot of condo boards and others are constantly looking at where they could get caught up in this kind of thing, and they let you know about it.
Linda writes, keep in mind with regard to quality and safety of building construction, contracts go to lowest bidders, which often means the lowest of acceptable materials, quickest construction, and inexperienced labor. Then there is this letter from Telly writes, I find the rambling conversation about the Florida collapse includes a number of misleading statements. So I think this is critical of us. So
okay.
I will read this very seriously.
Brace
so we
yourselves.
Do not ramble. For example, the role and legal authority of a homeowners association, as that term is generally used, is vastly different than a condominium. As to responsibility, it is the condominium owners collectively, whether they knew what owning a condominium entails or not, who were responsible. It is a classic example of economic externality. The owners failed to expend the fund to maintain their property, as a result of which a huge burden falls on the public. I'm not sure what the point of that was, but I do think, I mean, the homeowners associations are the one that those are the elected people or condo board that go and overlook this information for all of those who are living in that facility, right?
Yeah. So it's the way I've understood it.
Okay. But thank you very much. We appreciate it. All right. Let's move on to other things. We'll talk about this topic as well while we're talking about homes and living and where you live. A slow trickle of rental aid heightens concern about an eviction crisis, being called a five-alarm fire. Of billions of dollars allotted by Congress for emergency relief, only $1.5 billion has been spent by the end of May, according to Treasury Department data. The White House, along with state and local governments, is under growing pressure to significantly ramp up the amount of emergency rental relief reaching tenants and landlords, as some economists and housing advocates say the Biden administration's attention to the eviction crisis is coming too late. Weeks before an eviction moratorium put in place by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention expires on July 31st, much of the federal aid meant to help tenants and landlords has not reached them. Many are not even aware that the assistance is available, or they continue to struggle with onerous and complicated application rules. Some programs run by state and local governments took months to get up and running. All told, Congress has appropriated roughly $46 billion. Keep that in mind as I remind you of the earlier statement that $1.5 billion has been spent thus far. The $1.5 billion had been spent on rent, utilities, and arrears between January and the end of May, according to figures released Friday by the Treasury Department. Treasury does not yet have data on how much of the other $21 billion has been spent, that according to agency officials. Many parts of the economy show signs of improvement from the wild swings of 2020, but housing has proved especially complicated. Home prices are soaring, boxing out many potential buyers. Meanwhile, tenants behind on rent and landlords strapped for income are on unstable ground. One more thing before we throw this to the group. The CDC's eviction moratorium has been intended to keep people in their homes, but it does not erase bills once they come due. The moratorium will not be extended past July 31st. Heather?
Well, I think it illustrates a whole bunch of problems. One, inconsistency across state and local governments and the administration of federal programs in ways that are not consistent across the board. There's no clear direction as to when to apply. There's also the issue of the what you just pointed out, moratorium. Some people think it's a moratorium on rent, right? That they don't owe the rent. So they may not be looking for these programs because it's not money that's going to go in their pocket. It's money that's going to go from their pocket to their landlord's pocket, right? So if they don't think they owe it, they may not, you know, think to apply for it. Now, I think there's going to be a huge reality check when the variety of moratoriums, and there are federal, state, and local moratoriums, and that in and of itself is confusing. As those start getting lifted, you know, having very easily accessible programs and funds to allow this to get basically resolved is going to be critical. And I don't think that I don't think we're anywhere near that. I mean, I just think having this whole crisis has really pointed out some of the problems of the way that our federal and state governments are structured, you know, in as to who's responsible for what. I mean, if you look at vaccinations or closed down orders or masking orders or any of that stuff, this is just another layer of that.
Sienna?
As Heather was speaking, I was just thinking about the implications of this as it comes out and all the lawsuits that, you know, landlord-tenant claims are going to happen because people don't understand what a moratorium is. And so there has to be either some outreach to the landlord so they know that they can point their tenants to these resources, or once again, this is going to land in the court system, and what's going to happen is going to come in front of the judge, and the judge is going to say to the tenant or the landlord, have you applied for aid? And it's going to be clogging up our court system, which is already clogged up because of what happened last year. So that's where it needs to be outreach. I myself didn't know about the aid. You know, I haven't seen anything on TV, which is where it should probably be, to, you know, get it out to everybody.
Get your aid now. Come on now.
I mean, you don't think it's needed, but it's needed because I really don't think, like you said, that people understand.
Yeah. Well, and I think the federal government and state government, we're really good at figuring out how to get money from people.
Yeah.
Right? Tax money. And we will find people, or I mean, get the you know, the college fundraiser guys on this stuff who can find you 30 years after you graduated and ask you for a donation. You know,
that's true.
I mean, that's what you need. You need people who know how to do this, right? And I just don't think that there's a structure in place that says, hey, we've decided you at the local government level or state government level, you're the people who can contact everyone. There's real property taxes on every single property. There's got to be a mechanism to use that. But again, we're asking people to do things that they've not done before. So.
Right.
And so what we will likely see is a fair number of people losing their homes, also being pushed out of their apartments, especially if they're, you know, less informed, don't have a lot of resources or access to resources, have lost their jobs. So what we will see is a wave of families being kicked out of apartments. And as we know, currently the costs of apartments and houses has skyrocketed, which means local communities will have to face some really serious housing insecurities. And we know this is already beginning here in Albany and in the larger capital region. I mean, I work right down here with community members, and that is exactly the initial movement that we see. Apartments are not available. If people are losing their apartments, they will be homeless, and nonprofits and churches and various other community organizations will have to step in.
And, you know, we've seen an increase in violence, and when people have that instability, they're going to start, it's going to go up even more. Mm-hmm.
And I'll stand up for the landlords here for a second.
Someone has to go ahead.
I mean, New York actually has relatively good tenant protection laws, depending on where you are. But but for the most part, New York is one of the better states as far as tenant protection goes. But let's just say you have a tenant who is awful, who you wanted to evict before this. Mm-hmm. Good luck. Good luck. Even when the moratorium is lifted, it's going to be really hard for people to actually get through just the court system. I mean, it's going to be clogged up, as you mentioned. And I think it's going to be a real exercise in people trying to figure out what, you know, where do we direct this person? Do we direct them into this nonprofit setting to find somewhere else? Or do we point them in the here's the funding that you can get to get square with your landlord? And then if they're the landlord that says, well, I want them out anyways, then what do you do? I mean, there's all kinds of layers here of forestalled decision making usually doesn't have a better result, right?
And I would just say very quickly is that there's a portion of people that don't feel comfortable going to court, right? Mm-hmm. So they may not go to when you put that eviction notice, or if they're served, they just leave.
They just leave
and they just run, and those are the people that we're concerned about. There's people that are willing to go to court, and there are people who will avoid it at all costs. Yeah.
And I think it also depends if you're a multi-unit owner, you're in a totally different situation than when you have one apartment you're renting, or you know if you own large segments of apartment buildings. Again, it depends on how much money and resources you have.
Yeah, absolutely. And most landlords are one or two units. Right. You know.
We have to take a break. We'll do that. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Heather Brachetti, and Vera Acarias-Kelly. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We want to get the story in before we go to a break at the top of the hour, and that is the issue of what is happening in Haiti. This is a really wild story, so the which I will get to in just a second because I've just been logged out of my my account. So the president in Haiti is killed, and then yesterday four people were killed in retaliation for that. I guess not arrested, but killed. Correct?
Yeah, there was a shootout between police and military units affiliated or controlled by the Haitian government, and then they apparently had abducted four police officers and held them, and there was a shootout, and four of the assailants or murderers of the president of Haiti, Moïse, were shot dead, and two others arrested. But we don't know anything about them really yet, and I wonder if we will find out.
It was at his private residence on the outskirts of the capital, Port-au-Prince. The authorities said late Wednesday that they had intercepted, quote, suspected assassins. The police have engaged in a battle with the assailants, according to the police chief, at a news conference noting that the authorities were still in pursuit of some suspects. We're pursuing them so that in a gunfight, they meet their fate, or in gunfight they die, or we apprehend them. The authorities did not name any of the suspects or cite any evidence linking them to the assassination. Meanwhile, millions of Haitians anxiously huddled around radios and TVs throughout the day, staying off the streets as they try to understand who killed the president. Talk a little bit about the turbulent situation there.
So, I mean, we have to remember about 2 million Haitian diaspora members live in the United States, so people with Haitian heritage, and about 550,000 recent Haitian immigrants live in Florida, so they've been paying very close attention to what's been happening. This particular president was not elected with an overwhelming amount of support. He also remained in power past the time when he should have called for presidential elections. He was called sort of an old school, possibly, dictatorial kind of person. There was a lot of crime, unrest in the country. Just in June alone, some 5,000 people had moved out of their homes to try and get away from gang-related violence. So Haiti itself, unfortunately, was again in a pattern of weakening democratic structures and increasing violence. Now, that may be the background to this particular assassination. While Moïse was not popular, I think Haitian Americans are deeply distraught about what happened, because what they wanted was an election to be called and a democratic process to go forward, and what they find is the exact opposite.
And so what's the U.S. role here, Vera?
The U.S. role will be, first of all, the First Lady of Haiti was flown out to Florida.
Right.
She's in treatment there. They're trying to save her life. She was shot multiple times. I think they probably brought the children out for their safety, too, who were in the house during the assassination. And now, of course, a major concern is what are the long-term consequences? Will Haiti once again turn worse? Increasing levels of violence. Will we have, the United States is very concerned about another huge wave of Haitian immigration, of course. So that's the primary concern. And then also, what are the consequences in terms of stabilizing what is left of democracy?
I will say, just very briefly, is that, in 2010, the United States awarded temporary protected status to Haitians here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And in March, I want to say March, no, maybe May. In May, President Biden awarded, he said that he was going to renew the temporary protected status for Haitians. This was something that had run out before under the Trump administration, that they were going to end this. And so I do think that was an indicator that they knew that something wasn't going right in Haiti, that the fact that President Biden was willing to award temporary protected status again to Haitians. And so we've been waiting, immigration attorneys at least have been waiting for the regulations for so they can have some kind of lawful status, not lawful, authorized status in the U.S. Mm-hmm. so they can work for individuals from Haiti. And so with this happening, I imagine that those regulations will go through a little bit faster. Yeah. But as someone who has Haitian clients, I know that what we do a lot of asylum claims for on their behalf always has to do with corruption. Mm-hmm. And the government and what they went through and not feeling safe in their country. And so it has been a constant story that I've heard over the years, unfortunately, out of Haiti.
Haiti has a long history of corruption at the governmental levels. And there was Papa Doc Duvalier and his son Baby Doc. Yeah. And true story, I had two roosters on my farm who were named after them at one point, Papa Doc and Baby Doc, because they were brutal dictators to the other chickens. So, but they have this history of brutality.
Always comes back to farm animals.
It does, yeah. But the U.S. has some responsibility, and we've tacitly supported, very corrupt leadership. And the assassination and kidnapping cycle is something that goes back, 50, 100 years. Mm-hmm. It's really unfortunate. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. And, my family has a number of friends who are Haitian who are relocated to Florida, but are always ever hopeful that, you know, there'll be some stability restored because it has huge, you know, huge possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm fascinated. There's a side piece in the story that supposedly one of the reports says that one of the assassins spoke Spanish.
Yeah.
This is supposed to be meaningful somehow, like it's outsiders.
I can tell you why it's meaningful, because Haiti has a very tough relationship with the Dominican Republic,
right. Mm-hmm.
And Haitians to this day serve in, as domestics and as, in horrific conditions on sugarcane plantations in the Dominican Republic. And Dominicans have carried out multiple, genocidal attacks on Haitian workers in the Dominican Republic, and Haitians do not ever get citizenship in the Dominican Republic. This is a very tough, tough history between those two countries. And so when you speak Spanish, that means they're suggesting that these are possible Dominican assassins.
Interesting.
And, that's what's behind that suggestion.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Dominican is the only country that shares a land border with Haiti. So
correct.
They closed their border.
Yep.
During this incident. And that just shows you the kind of the tension between the two countries.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
Just for anyone who's listening, Haiti is a former French colony, so they speak French.
Yeah.
Well, and Creole.
Yeah.
So I want to make two quick recommendations for people interested in Dominican and
Haitian.
You have
one quick minute.
Yep. Henry Louis Gates wrote one of the best books that has chapters in it. It's called Black in Latin America, fabulous chapter on the Haitian history, American involvement, and Dominican. And also, we have a fabulous Haitian-American writer by the name of Edwidge Danticat, who writes fabulous stories about
Edwidge Danticat.
Her one of her really interesting books about Papadoc's period is called The Dewbreaker. So I would highly recommend, if you're interested in that particular history, those are fantastic books to read.
Agreed. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Heather Bruschetti, and Vera Karius-Kelly. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. We also have Heather Bruschetti and Vera Karius-Kelly with us this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we always love your letters. We just ask that they're short and to the point and no links. What else am I forgetting, Alan? I think,
I just thought you were very kind when you said we always love everybody's letters.
Well, sure.
Because some of them are not so nice.
Yeah, there's that. Okay, so let's go to other stories then, and we'll talk about that you can write to us about. We do have a letter about Haiti. Mike says we should look to Haiti to see what the Republican Party has in mind for the U.S. We narrowly avoided a descent into chaos on January 6th. We cannot count on this outcome again. If we value democracy, we will have to maintain it. That from Mike.
Yeah, that's true. The thing that always bothers me when I think about that situation is the how question. How do we maintain it? Because we see them trying to subvert state legislatures so that the Secretary of State can't call an election and all of that. That's what's so scary to me. I think, Trump was always talked about fixing, rigging elections. Is now proving once again that what he accuses of others of doing is what he does himself. And so there's an awful lot of rigging going on. So I'm worried about how we put a stop to that.
Anybody else? Okay. Let's go to this story about somewhat related when it comes to Trump. He has filed a lawsuit. And just for the record, everyone in the studio just started shaking their head. Trump files a class action lawsuit targeting Facebook, Twitter, and Google's YouTube over, quote unquote, censorship of conservatives. Former President Donald Trump filed a class action suit targeting the companies, escalating his long-running battle with the companies following their suspensions of his accounts. Legal experts and business associations immediately criticized the claims, predicting they had little chance of succeeding in court. But the lawsuits filed in federal district court in Miami raised a series of legal claims that will find favor among Trump's most fervent supporters, who have long argued that the social media companies treat conservative voices unfairly. We're demanding an end to the shadow banning, a stop to the silencing, and a stop to the blacklisting, banishing, and canceling that you know so well, according to Trump. The suits allege that the companies violated Trump's First Amendment rights in suspending his accounts, and argues that Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, which is owned by Google, no longer should be considered private, but a state actor whose actions are constrained by First Amendment restrictions on government limitations of free speech. Traditionally, the First Amendment constrains only government actions, not those of private companies. So there's many places we can start on this, but
well, but we know that it's not a government agency.
Right.
It's going to get thrown out because of that.
I mean, the former president is well known for filing such lawsuits and having them
It'll become a fundraising tool for him, I think. Yeah. It's definitely going to be a fundraising. But I do, I mean, just to be devil's advocate here a little bit, by the way, I think the lawsuit has no shot. But we need to be talking about whether or not, or what constitutes a public forum. Because at some point, there is a reckoning here. Like, if everyone is getting their information off of Twitter and Facebook, is there some point where there's a blurring of the line? And are the rules that are in place governing the responsibility of website hosters, owners, or whatever, Section 230 or whatever, which is, you know, very old at this point, do we need to be thinking seriously about reforming them and putting something in place that is more reflective of present-day forms of communication? But that being said, I do not think this lawsuit has a shot.
Well, that's interesting enough. There was a Second Circuit case where they found, I think, the Knights of something, I forget what it was, they sued Donald Trump for blocking them on Twitter because they said it was a form of public forum. And the Second Circuit said that's true. It's a form of public forum. He can't block individuals from following him and, you know, commenting, you know, against him under his Twitter page. So there is some litigation going on about that aspect of it. But, you know, I think what happened here is, you know, unfortunately, Trump was unable to, his blogs weren't popular. And he doesn't have his own company that he can, you know, publicize his voice on, because that's the right thing to do if he really wanted to do it. The right thing to do is not to file a lawsuit against Twitter and Facebook and say they're state actors. We all know that's not the case. So like you said, I think that's a fundraising tool and a response to his failure to be able to get his voice out there like he wants to.
And to your point, Heather, if you're using this as a fundraising tool, it, given what we just read, could be quite successful given how his supporters feel those conservative voices being silenced.
There's a lot of I dislike or hating going on against some of these big tech companies on both sides of the aisle. You know, there's antitrust, legislation being contemplated. The companies haven't necessarily done themselves a huge amount of favors, how they have responded to some criticism. So I do, there's a lot to be worked out here. I don't think this is going to be, you know, the starting point of working out how do we handle people putting misinformation up on Facebook or Twitter, because that really is at the core of it, right? Putting out messages that are potentially dangerous or misleading. What responsibility does the web host or whatever you want to call it, like Facebook, what responsibility do they have for the content? I mean, there's a lot of complexity that needs to be discussed. But again, I don't think the lawsuit is going to be the starting point of those discussions.
And, you know, I always say, we always chuckle because we still watch the YouTube videos when Mark was down at Congress trying to answer questions. I don't know if our Congress is, they have the words or the, you know, the knowledge to have that conversation.
I love that you're on a first name basis with Mark Zuckerberg. Good for you.
Mark and I, you know, Mark, we were chatting the other day.
Mark is down in the district talking to those
boys. I know all the tech giants.
Yeah. But, you know, the idea of conservative voices being silenced, let's just talk about that for a second. Because, and I know this is going to sound flip, but if you say they're silenced, okay. But the reason in this case they're being silenced is because it's nutty. Right, I mean, it doesn't seem to be rooted in any fact or reality, and so if a conservative voice said, "I feel that we should do this, 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 and this," having to do with the tax code or deficit spending or whatever the case may be, okay, that's fine. But if you start talking about, oh, I don't know, taking over the Capitol, or whatever the case may be, then that becomes dangerous. I mean, that isn't so much a silencing a conservative voice. That is great concern over inaccurate information getting out that can be extremely harmful.
True, yeah. True. But there's a lot of nutty stuff that's on there that is not conservative. Nutty stuff that is potentially dangerous that is not
Absolutely.
Conservative, that does not get shut off. You know, kids doing stupid things, with soda and Pop Rocks, but things that could be dangerous. At, you know,
that was a great reference. Isn't that how Mikey died? Didn't
right,
that
is
a long time ago?
That's what I heard.
Urban legend debunked. But,
ahead. But no, but my point is their argument is that you're singling us out, even if it's they're not going to admit that their stuff is nutty, right?
No.
But they're saying you're looking at just one subset of people, and you're saying we're going to shut you off, but we're not going to shut you off over here who want to have a rally around some other issue that could potentially lead to looting and violence. And you're not shutting off those conversations. You're just shutting off our conversations, and therefore it is selective.
Right.
Now, the argument back is it's private sector. You can be as selective as you want. You can shut off, you know, just your cousin, you know, your cousin that you can't stand. You shut him off and nobody else. But that's where I
By
was
the
saying.
By the way, how did you know I did that? No,
it's becoming a gray area.
when you look at that, though, I mean, arguably, the one I saw on Facebook yesterday was that because you mentioned soda and just made me think of this, that apparently teens are downing Coca-Cola so they can fake a result for the COVID test. Did you read this?
No.
Okay, so that's something that's out there,
right.
And so. But that isn't like that is nutty. I don't know scientifically if it's true or not. I have no idea. But it's out there. That's different than sort of what's going to Comet Ping Pong Pizza, wherever the hell it was in D.C. Mm-hmm. and shooting up the place.
Oh, agree. I'm not saying that there aren't the really valid reasons to shut them off. I'm just saying their argument is you're only shutting us off. You're not shutting anyone else off, and therefore, you know, our rights are being violated in some way. In order for that to be true, though, it would have to be a public forum. Mm-hmm. And I do think that we're going to have some discussions about that, because it is sort of a quasi-public forum in some respects. And there's no fact-checking, which makes it even worse. But
and I think some of the Europeans are beginning to have those conversations and creating some parameters around that. And we'll see it eventually affect the United States, because those are not separated market anyways, you know.
Right.
But I think coming back to Joe's original point is also interesting, the question of, you know, should you have productive, helpful proposals out there, or should you have, you know, like Trump seems to be in the business and his supporters just simply, you know, whining, complaining, stating something about how unfair you know, media is to them, when in fact he himself didn't succeed in creating his own media channel, his own ideas, right? And so he's back in the defensive, on the defensive. He's not producing any sort of really valuable public conversation. When it comes to violence, when it comes to misinformation, I think there's a need for public parameters around those kinds of conversations,
yep.
You know, because if it's harmful for society, and I think that's where a lot of the Europeans are, let's look at what should be curtailed. And it doesn't matter what your political position is, if it's harmful and misinforming the general public, misleading, then it might have to be looked at.
Yeah, see, but you need to make sure that there's a neutral arbiter of that, right?
And there'll never be a neutral arbiter. Exactly. That's why I'm of the opinion that unless it incites violence, I think it should all be, you know, it's all, I hate to use the word free speech because these are private actors. So, but I mean, I just think that there it's hard to regulate it. I mean, it's just, you can have the soda pop and the Tide Pod issue, you know, they all that can be on there. Yeah. You know, and you can't regulate it. You just have to leave it.
So what about if it's not violent, but it kills people, like misinformation about the COVID vaccines?
It's a slippery slope for me. It's a very slippery slope.
What if it's a personally destructive and false information? I mean, there's...
Well, coming from someone who is elected, I mean, if you have not only... I mean, obviously Trump was president and was bumped off of these platforms at the end of his presidency, but the many people of his acolytes who are still in the Senate and the Congress and throughout offices, political offices throughout the country... are putting this stuff out and retweeting and also sharing information that is coming from a public official.
But I mean, think about it a different way. What if someone who has the comfort of anonymity, because we can all make up a fake name and start our own, you know, email address or Twitter handle or whatever, you can say things about people that are massively destructive to them professionally. You can make something up, and there's been a lot of examples of this where people have had their lives and reputations destroyed by someone who's got an axe to grind, and there's no consequences because you can't find out who the person is. And it becomes this thing where it's the first thing that pops up on a Google search is some false story about a person. There's a lot that has to be worked out here.
That's me regulations, right? You want regulations where, you know, the companies have something in place where they can identify these individuals so that if someone makes defamatory comments, then you can sue, you can subpoena, you can, you know, gather information that way. But we have to protect the right to say whatever you want as long as you're not inciting violence. We have to protect that, unfortunately. You know, I think that you think about, I don't even want to go down that, but just, you know, I just think that there's misinformation is a very big slippery slope. I think that's it's a hard thing to regulate. And it's hard for me. Inciting violence is easier to say when someone's going to hurt or harm another individual.
Right.
Misinformation, it depends on what side of the aisle you are or where what your position is, or, you know, I just think it's harder, especially on the internet, where there's all kind of random and, you know, things out there that people say about a lot of different topics.
I think you're so right. The problem is and because it is a slippery slope, there's no question that it will be useful to him to say, "See what they're doing to me, and this is what's happening." And yet, he is such a dangerous man. I mean, there's the potential for changing our democratic government into a fascistic state, and people are taking all kinds of chances of this kind in blocking him. And I think that that's what this discussion is about. But I think there's a real risk. We had here at WAMC, we had Herb London, and Herb London was a conservative columnist. And there wasn't a day that I didn't get a thing saying, "Get rid of him. And get a real conservative on the on the air." And I would say, and then he died. And then the next guy came on and they say, "Get rid of him. Get a real conservative on." I think it's a slippery slope. I do.
I think the Second Circuit had it right. I think that if a public official, like you guys are all saying, is giving misinformation, I think it'd be regulated. I think that is a public forum. But I think that everyone else, unfortunately, commenting on what's happening with COVID or what's happening with the vaccine or, you know, what have you, we can't regulate that. I think it's just very hard to do so.
He's not going to get his way. We all agree on that, right?
Yeah.
We know that, but he will get his way in that he's using it to point out to his followers what's being done, quote, being done to him.
What I find also important for this kind of conversation is how a lot of young people are affected by social media, how it affects their psyche, their ability to decipher what is accurate, what is inaccurate information. I think that is something that we're not so good at in this country in terms of teaching people to filter out, disconnect, or decipher, you know, how to actually find supporting evidence for certain ideas. There's a lot of believing or you know, sort of following celebrities, and that is creating sort of a society where people are not necessarily automatically independent thinkers. And that is worrisome.
Yeah, spoken right on the spoken internet. Like a true college professor.
I can say that you don't want to you read a headline, mm-hmm. and you take whatever the headline says and you run with it. You don't want to read more than 140 characters. I mean, not many people want to read the whole article. I mean, that's the phenomenon that we're dealing with. So I do think misinformation is an issue. I just think it's hard to regulate.
All right, let's go to some letters that are on this very topic. Bob said, when the president or former president of the United States speaks on whatever platform, it gets attention as opposed to kids doing stupid things for attention on social media. Well, they're not doing it just for attention. They're also doing it to fake a positive COVID test so they can get out of school.
Is that really working?
Apparently it. Well, I don't know, but you got to give them credit. I mean, we used to just take the thermometer and put it on the light bulb. Fever,
fake
you know,
fever.
And then, you know, knock it down so, it, you know, you didn't have 108 fever and had to go to the hospital, but just enough. But this is a little bit different. Anyway, so Bob writes, when Trump needs attention, he sues. Doesn't matter if it has merit, but it sure gets attention, which is what he wants.
That's right.
Roger says he has found another way to milk money from his lemmings with his lawsuit. Win or lose the lawsuit, he can still make a profit off of this. Ben said, I don't hear any discussion about the algorithms that bring controversial speech to the forefront of all these apps, because that's what keeps people glued to their screens and drives up the advertising revenue.
Certainly correct.
Yeah, I mean, it's partially correct, I think. I mean, it isn't just controversial speech that bring people to these screens. It's also puppy and kitty videos.
And the guy, like, on a skateboard with, you know, music on, riding behind a van. I mean, yeah. Like, the most watched video, which I finally watched.
Because you were doing research.
I was, yes.
Yeah. Trump, Tom says, Trump is the forever complainer. He'll never stop whining about how mistreated, persecuted, and oppressed he is, and his followers just eat it up by the double handful.
And while he does the same thing.
The problem, as the panel has been discussing, is that he has too much influence. Conservatives and Republicans know he'll do whatever they want to eventually mutate democracy into something that only respects money and power.
And maybe race the way that he's doing it.
And maybe distract from the indictment last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just maybe. Max says Twitter permanently banned Naomi Wolf for spreading vaccine misinformation. So they do ban non-officials for misinformation. I know there have been some cases, but how long they go for and so forth is, you know, and again, how do you regulate that? Ben said, I think we already heard from Ben, didn't we? Phil says, Trump's legal team is complicit in pursuing a baseless claim. I don't think that reinstating Trump's accounts on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube is the goal. His purpose here is to keep his base enraged while simultaneously scamming them for donations and to keep himself in the news. And the media, once again, is taking the bait. It is interesting, however, that without him on those platforms, we don't have the nuttiness that you know would be reported if it were easier to find, right? From the president, the former president.
So should the media not report on this? I don't get that.
No, meaning that if
no,
if,
I know what you're saying. Just simply saying, should the media not report that Trump is bringing this lawsuit? They have to.
They have to.
Yeah.
But if they don't report that he said, you know, who shot Ashley Babbitt, and that is a press release that his office puts out. Well, it would have been a tweet. So if it were a tweet, then it probably would be reported more. don't you think?
Yeah, because it'd be read more. Yeah.
It would be read more.
Yeah, I mean, not everyone reads the Washington Post, but everyone reads Twitter, right? I don't know.
Well, it's true. Yeah. And so without those, basically, what I'm ultimately saying is, without him on those platforms, it just seems quieter.
Yeah, I'd say it's better for our mental health, I believe. Not for yours, okay, but for mine.
No, I mean, I don't. I mean, to me, it's all about politics. And are you creating a political dimension here in which he benefits by saying, "Look at what those quote liberals are doing to me by not letting me speak"? I think it's very dangerous.
But it's whatever he says. It's not, you know, his framing doesn't mean represents reality. I think there are a lot of people that I know who are traditional Republicans, and they're like, oh, thank God that man is off of Twitter.
But here's the thing, though, about when you say about politics, that's the whole, they have this whole, those Republicans have this whole vacuum now where they don't have this way to reach the masses. Mm-hmm. So they have this whole hurdle to overcome. And I think that's what, part of me was thinking about this when he did the lawsuit was, mm-hmm. here comes the 2022 elections. Trump's not on Twitter. Trump's not on Facebook. You know,
they actually
on Facebook.
Have to do some work.
Yeah, they have to do some work to get their messaging out there. And that's a hard thing. It's easier to put Trump out there and for him to say, I endorse this person. I don't endorse this person.
Is he banned on TikTok? Do we know?
He does. Oh, no. He doesn't do TikTok.
I would hate to see that.
He tried to shut down TikTok. I don't know if TikTok would be as welcoming to him.
All right. We have to break. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll wrap up our conversation here on the Roundtable right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are talking about the lawsuit that the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, has leveled against the social media giants in federal court. Here's a letter from Keith, who writes, "It's all a sad and pathetic grift. The self-proclaimed billionaire needs donations to sue private companies because he lost an election, incited a violent coup attempt where people died, and ended up getting his precious social media accounts taken away by private companies. Trump is a broken individual who craves attention. He's more concerned about his social media accounts than the Constitution and country that he swore to uphold and protect. A normal person would leave in disgrace. The guy belongs in prison," says Keith.
Well, I agree with most of that. My problem is that Trump got elected president of the United States somehow, and he has a good chance, in my opinion, of having that happen again. You know, I mean, everybody here is going, no, he doesn't. But he is corrupting these state governments, the electors, and the rest of it, and you better believe he knows what he's doing, and they know what they're doing. So even though he remains at 32% or whatever in terms of the polls versus the 60s for Biden, we have seen that the Electoral College can be corrupted, and we have seen that he's aiming by changing the laws in these states to do it again. I think you have to take him extremely seriously.
I agree, and I also think that in taking him seriously, it's the erosion of, well, voting, of course, is the most obvious, but of, you can see like all of the parts being put together.
Absolutely.
Of him getting ready for this run in 2024, even for the midterms in next year, 22, and how Republicans are responding. I mean, to your point, Alan, I mean, obviously the Republican faithful would not be supporting him and thinking of him. They're not thinking of him the way that the listener just wrote about it. They're thinking of him as basically the savior who can get them back into office.
Savior of the white majority. That's what this is all about. It has been from the very beginning.
Hank says, 2 weeks ago, I was banned from Twitter forever for making one negative comment about Netanyahu. It was not an anti-Semitic remark, I'm Jewish myself, but I was tossed off immediately with no appeal accepted. It would appear that their algorithms are a bit too sensitive. Well, we don't know what the remark was, but thank you for sharing your story. Vesta says that New York University recently released a study which found conservative voices are not being silenced. As a matter of fact, their positions were being amplified. The right is using one of their favorite arguments of cancel culture to get their base riled up and fundraise. Trump violated the user agreement terms. He used platforms to encourage his supporters to show up to an assault on the Capitol. I mean, that is one thing. I mean, I know to the lawyers in the room, I mean, you do... I know nobody reads it, but you—I mean—when you sign on to these platforms, you agree to play by the rules, and the rules say you don't do that. And if you violate them, you
get the boot.
That's right.
You can get the boot, right? Oliver says the bigger Trump-related injustice with social media was in treating our disgraceful former president more privileged than other users and able to violate the term of service agreements again and again. Equality for all—that's the Democratic way. Let's see. I think I have one more. Trump agreed to user terms of service when he signed up. He broke the rules that he had not agreed to and was suspended. We were just mentioning that. It will be thrown out of court. It's nothing more than a distraction from the Trump Organization getting charged in New York, which I think you referenced earlier. Okay. Let's move on to other subjects as we have our final moments together, about 8 or 9 minutes left. So... I want to get to the story of Jacob Zuma, the former South African president, is arrested. The Constitutional Court has found him guilty of contempt for failing to appear before a commission investigating corruption accusations that tainted a president once best known for fighting apartheid. The Constitutional Court, the nation's highest judicial body, this from the New York Times, ordered Mr. Zuma's imprisonment last month after finding him guilty of contempt for failing to appear before a commission investigating corruption accusations that tainted his tenure as the nation's leader from 2009 to 2018. So he got out of office in 2018. It's now 2021, right. So it took 3 years for them to be arrested. I just want you to think about that when everyone in this country says, why isn't Trump behind bars?
It's just for contempt, too. It's not for corruption. I was in South Africa in 2018, right after the transition, and it was a place that was filled with hope. I mean, unemployment was very high. There are these massive slums outside Cape Town where people live in semi-permanent shelters. I mean, there's actually like satellite discs on these miles and miles of tin shacks that people have lived in. They have mailing addresses there. And there was all this hope that there was going to be this big change with the change in administration. I don't know that any of that has been realized, but... at the time, it was this sort of feeling that Zuma was so corrupt and had taken so much and not delivered to the people. And yet, here we are. It's 3 years later. He's being arrested on contempt charges, not on corruption charges, because he hasn't cooperated with the process, which just makes you wonder. I mean, they need him to prove the case against himself. I guess I'm sort of lost as to why not just charge him with corruption if it's so obvious that he was corrupt. I guess that part has me completely bewildered.
Vera?
Well, I mean, so part of the South African context is that you have Zuma represent the Zulu population,
right,
which is a very powerful, politically powerful ethnic group. And he is one of the long-lasting heroes of liberation. So I think the South African government might be a little reluctant going after the most revered leader among the Zulu population. So that could create some really serious violence. And they're afraid, I think.
And yet, from the very beginning, everybody sort of knew the guy was in.
Yeah, he was not.
He was not a
great star as a politician. That's for sure.
And not an appropriate follower for Mandela. That's for sure. Mm-hmm.
So, what do you think happens here from here on, with this case?
I think he'll be detained for a while, and then I think pretty much it will peter out. And he's not that young, so they're hoping he will somehow pass on to greener pastures. I don't know how one says that.
Or his greater reward.
So he is, you know, he's a very powerful politician, and he has so many connections, and he has a lot of friends that are still in very powerful positions. So I think they're just hoping that it will somehow work itself out through some detention and some official recognition that he has used his position for his, to his own benefit. And then we'll move on.
All right, let's talk about another story with world implications. The Japanese prime minister declared a new state of emergency in Tokyo on Thursday that will run throughout the Olympic Games to combat rising infections in the capital and the spread of the contagious Delta variant. In light of the announcement, the organizers of the Games held a meeting Thursday evening to discuss whether to implement further restrictions on spectators or whether to ban them entirely. They are due to announce their decision at a news conference just 2 weeks before the Games are due to be opened on July 23rd. The state of emergency, the fourth imposed in the capital, will start July 12th and run through the 22nd of August, with the prime minister asking bars and restaurants not to serve alcohol during that period, although the city streets are likely to remain packed during the daytime, as they have been during previous states of emergency this year. Olympic organizers, working closely with the government, had announced 2 weeks ago that they would allow some domestic spectators to attend events at the Games. They capped attendance at 10,000, or 50% of the venue's capacity, but warned at the time they might change course if infections rose again and a new state of emergency was declared. In remarks before Thursday evening's meeting, the president of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee pointed out that extensive precautions had already been taken to allow some spectators to attend events without compromising public safety, while organizers had also studied sports events around the world that have allowed fans to attend. Am I the only one that...
What hypocrisy, huh?
Well, it just seems like this is a really bad idea that we're having these...
It seems so last second. Like, everything is changing at the last second all the time. You know, like, every day. It doesn't seem like they planned this super well.
Well, they knew that they were in trouble here. They knew that they hadn't done what they needed with the COVID. And they kept the Games going, and now the guy's going, and he's saying the exact opposite. Well, we have to be careful of how we're doing this. It seems crazy.
Right now I'm thinking of a 22-year-old sprinter who, due to pot smoking, is not attending. And I'm thinking... You know, she wasn't allowed to attend. So I'm thinking, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe she should go next time. It'll be a safer environment
well,
in the first place.
We talked about that last week, that, you know, maybe like luck of the draw there, that you don't have to go over to this hotbed of COVID. But I just, you know, even a 50% capacity, I don't know, to me... 10,000 people seems like a lot of people.
I know. Well, if they're not serving alcohol, no one's going to go anyways, right? I'm like, come on.
I'm sort of thinking, when are the athletes beginning to pull out? Don't you think?
Well, I'm surprised we've gotten this far. I mean, it's 2 weeks away, and it seems to be that is the, you know, we're full speed ahead, even though the state of emergency, and it's the fourth one. And I mean, as you all just said, this has been going on for a really long time. Yeah. They had many, many opportunities to turn and say, let's either wait another year or we'll just cancel this one completely and do it the next time.
My understanding is that the athletes want to go. Like, they were the one pushing for this.
Absolutely.
Like, they've been training.
Sure.
I was watching a little something on Simone Biles, and she was saying how hard it was to maintain that level of training, you know.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, if you have a window almost every 4 years, and you go from being a 14-year-old athlete to an 18-year-old athlete to a 22-year-old athlete, I mean, you time tick-tock. And I get that, absolutely. But I don't know. Still, it is very concerning to send these athletes, even though I believe all of our American athletes are vaccinated and have to be vaccinated before going over.
Is that the case?
I believe so.
Huh. I hadn't heard that or read that. So, but yeah, I mean, it must be super frustrating now to do your Olympics without an audience. It's also, I suppose, less than, you know, inspiring when you do your,
And the trials
your competition
were very much
and
like
you
that
know,
as well.
But I mean, I just hope it all, whatever is left of it, I hope the athletes have a reasonably good experience.
We shall see. We'll end there this morning. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much.
Me
see
too.
You at Tanglewood tomorrow. Sienna and Heather and Vera, thank you all for
thank
being
you.
Here. We'll be back right after this.